Welcome to FitzArns Property Exchange, hosted by Pearl Skeltimer. Designed to keep you informed and captivated about the South African residential property market. Subscribe to our channel today and enjoy conversations with some of the most influential, innovative, and interesting industry experts, stakeholders, and scheme executives as they render input in today's property market.
Good day. I'm Pearl Skeltimer, the CEO of FitzArns Estates, and once again, welcome to FitzArns Property Exchange. As with any venture in life, tradition and long-conditioned thinking can bring about fixation, a concept that one readily accepts, perhaps not with a great deal of thought. By fixating on one thing, one tends to lose sight of a lot of other things. Administering community schemes are no different. And I've come to the realization that scheme executives tend to fixate on the SDSM Act or the Companies Act, as opposed to taking a holistic approach by considering various other legislation and common sense considerations to resolve real-time issues. So today, we intend on answering the age-old question: is it enough for a scheme executive to only understand the SDSMA or the Companies Act? The gentleman that's going to elaborate on this and take us through what we should be on the lookout for actually needs no introduction. Dylan Heerschop, he is a director at De Tooy Burger. He is the head of the Community Schemes Litigation Department at the firm. He specializes in the law pertaining to community schemes and all the concomitant appliance issues. He has obtained a master's degree in estate planning, giving him a keen insight into the financial aspects of community schemes. And if you are keen listeners or attend NAMA conventions or Let's Get Physical, anything that has to do with the property industry, Dylan Heerschop should be a well-known name. Dylan, so nice to talk to you.
Hi, Paul. Thank you very much, as always, for having me. It's a really dynamic platform, and I love being part of these podcasts.
Awesome. So let's kick off. Is being a scheme executive an easy job?
In the most tongue-in-cheek way possible, yes. So the answer is actually no. I've come to realize that a lot of us are self-proclaimed SDSMA or Companies Act experts as scheme executives. But the practical problem that we may be faced with is that oftentimes the solution to this community schemes problem is not found in the SDSMA or the Companies Act. Sometimes scheme executives will be tasked with utilizing other legislation or a common sense approach in order to now resolve conflict within a community scheme. And I think a few interesting examples that we'll touch on today is labor laws, or PIA, managing service providers, managing attorneys, and also then managing one's managing agent.
Okay, I could actually think of a lot more. Everything that has to do with the CSOS and how to lodge claims and all of that. So you mentioned that scheme executives must be wary of labor laws. Can you please elaborate on this?
Yes, so I think a good starting point, and I like to use the annotation of Wim Johan. So I'm going to sketch this factual matrix for us. This is now Wim Johan, who is a retired chairperson at a community scheme. He's now explained to the gardener approximately 700 times how to cut his specific rose bushes that he's looking after in the scheme. And it seems that the gardener simply does not understand how the roses should be trimmed. In a fit of rage, Wim Johan gets to his roses that are now beautifully trimmed without any flowers, nothing. It's just a little bush. And Wim Johan loses it. And he, in fact, fires the gardener. Mm-hmm. So now the question that we face with here is that we've got two, in my mind, we've got two types of labor offenses, if we can call it offenses, and we need to understand the differences between them. So the one is misconduct, which relates to dishonesty, refusal to adhere to lawful instruction, perhaps the gardener was a bit late, theft, intimidation or assault or verbal abuse or anything like that of that nature, intoxication, etc. So those types of offences, if we can call it that, falls within the category of misconduct in a labour dispute. And then the second category is poor work performance. And I mean, there, the name suggests what it is. You've got certain expectations of a person that you're employing and they're not performing to those expectations. So if we zoom in a bit on misconduct, we need to understand that firstly, the punishment must fit the crime. So for example, the gardener being late once for 5 minutes may not be a situation where Wim-Johan is now entitled to hire and fire. We should also understand that minor offences, as I said, lateness, first offences, may not or cannot warrant dismissal, but we also have major offences where it may warrant dismissal. And these might be stuff like gross dishonesty, theft, habitual lateness, intimidation, being under the influence of some or other substance whilst at the workplace. But the unfortunate reality is that there is no silver bullet, a 1+1=2 situation, and each of the merits must be then considered on a case-to-case basis.
Okay, so what it boils down to is there's serious offences that might result in dismissal or less serious offences where a specific process of issuing warning letters must be done.
Yes, exactly that.
And
we've now dealt with misconduct to an extent. The second category is poor work performance. So this is now where we've got this expectation of our employee to render a specific task or set of tasks, and they're not doing it. So it's important in any situation where we're dealing with discipline relating to poor work performance that from the outset that we should outline an employee's responsibilities in the form of an employment letter or an employment agreement if it's a very fancy community scheme where they've got time for stuff such as agreements. And then if there is no thing in place, do it now. That's my best advice at this stage. It's difficult to discipline an employee where there's no clear understanding or communication in relation to what we expect of them.
Okay, sorry. Can I just interrupt you? So the foundation basically is to have a proper agreement in place, including a proper job description and then the disciplinary code, if I may refer to it as such. So if there's an offence of either misconduct or work performance, that you can refer back to the agreement that was initially signed.
Exactly that. And you've almost taken the words out of my mouth.
Okay. So what happens if an employee refuses to sign an agreement?
So at that stage, that to an extent may constitute misconduct in itself. And then we can also start looking towards a labor relationship. Yes. And taking
labor
steps.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So the fact
that they don't sign an official agreement is misconduct. And secondly, whether they sign or not, the principle of the agreement still applies.
Yes. So, but I mean, ultimately, we're now discussing a situation where there wasn't any agreement at the start, and we're now in the middle of our relationship. We want to now start dealing with that. But the important part is that the responsibility should not radically change. I mean, in general, a gardener would have certain responsibilities, and that
of
may
course.
Not include building walls. And I don't know, I've heard interesting stories of gardeners.
I understand.
And the guiding principle in relation to dealing with this or disciplining an employee is that we must understand that progressive or corrective discipline must be implemented. So what is progressive or corrective discipline? This means firstly, and as you've indicated, Paul, that the employee must know and understand the standards of workmanship that is required from him, her, or them. And then secondly, when we now get into a situation where we see, listen, the gardener is not performing as we would have expected or as we would have wanted, that an effort must be made by the scheme executives to correct this employee's poor performance. So this can include meetings, training, advice, and also then official warnings to try and steer away from this poor work performance.
Okay. I think what most of my scheme executives would say is, Fitzan, this is your problem because you are our managing agent. But what my scheme executives do not realize is that they are the employer. So we handle the administration on their behalf, but the responsibility remains that of the scheme executive.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would also say that in the conventional management agreement or managing agent relationship, that this is not necessarily a responsibility unless it's not specifically contractually agreed. But as you said, the employer remains the scheme and not the ZAN.
Correct. Okay. This is very interesting. I may be speaking out of my place, but do you have any labor tips for our avid listeners?
Yes, Paul, definitely. As you know, I like to categorize things in some form of humoristic place, but ultimately what I've categorized as the 10 commandments of labor law is the following. So the first thing is keep written records of everything. Even if you don't think it's relevant, at the end of the day, when the relationship sours, we don't want to have an instance where we don't have written records, and then we're dealing with he said, she said. I mean, ultimately, when we discipline the employee, it'll probably be denied till I die, and then we've got difficulty with proving what we've actually discussed or whatever the subject matter was that we wanted to keep records of. So that's the first one. The second one is...
Good point.
Have the employee sign everything or have a witness signed. And I'll explain it now. So when we have a warning, we must have a situation similar to the keeping of written records, but have the employee also sign towards that. And when the employee refuses to sign, and I've seen these types of things when we start talking about warnings, when we start talking about giving notice of a disciplinary hearing, then the employee may refuse to sign a document for some or other, I don't know, type of benefit in that situation, where we can then easily utilize a witness that is there with us that signs and confirms that this person refuses to sign, but I, as a witness, actually witnessed that this was given to the employee.
Okay.
Then the next one is emotional decision making is a big no-no. As with the factual matrix, when Johan, in a fit of rage about the roses, told the gardener to leave. The moment we get emotional, that is when we start saying things that are out of line. That is when we start making decisions that are out of line. And the CCMA will definitely then come to the aid of the employee if this is a situation where the emotions have not actually crossed the line. And that, so keep emotion out of any situation. And I mean, I understand we're all humans and sometimes in the heat of the moment, some things happen, but that's when the advice is maybe drink a cup of coffee or smoke a cigarette or whatever is your situation where you can unwind a bit before you deal with this employee.
I'm sure when your aunt will have a bottle of whiskey ready for that.
Number four is when in doubt, give a warning. So if we're not sure whether what we're doing warrants dismissal, when there's even a shadow of a doubt, rather give a warning to make sure that we're on the right side of the labor situation here. We all know that the CCMA is very employee-centric, and the employer, to say the least, has an uphill battle to get to a favorable decision. So in those circumstances, if you're unsure and it's not a clear-cut case of the gardener stole the wheat eater and there's a huge breach of trust, then start considering rather giving a warning.
Okay.
Then we also need to know the fifth one is constructive dismissal is a thing. So not a lot of us are aware what constructive dismissal is, but that is active steps taken by an employer to make the work environment intolerable. And as a result of this intolerance, the person has actually given notice. So this is an unfair labor practice. We cannot create or fabricate a sequence of events where we make it so unbearable that the employee now actually turns around and gives notice, because that will give them recourse at the CCMA or at the Labour Court. And just an example so that we unpack the situation with regards to the gardener, this may be where we actually now give the gardener scissors to go and cut the grass, and he's got a spoon to go and deal with the lawns. So that's unacceptable practices. I mean, any person, even me, if I was handed the scissors and said, well, you should go and cut the grass, I wouldn't be very happy.
You would take your bag and go, for sure.
Exactly.
I would have joined you. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
So that's
Number six
is a good labor case starts with a verbal and a written warning or more. There's very few instances where summary dismissal should be used as an avenue. And I'm talking about theft and those types of things. Yes, it's understandable that we can do summary dismissal. But for example, poor work performance, the first time the grass is not cut properly, or the first time the rose bush is not properly trimmed, that doesn't warrant that we now tell a person to leave. So always give warnings. This is the second time we've mentioned warnings. So it's actually very important in the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
Then disciplinary hearings are beneficial most of the time. And I mean, this relates to procedural and substantive fairness, which is a guiding principle in our labor law. A disciplinary hearing needs to happen. And then number eight, they deal hand in hand with each other. A disciplinary hearing consists of three role players. I've seen a lot of people confuse this with and think it's only two, but it's actually three. The first role player is the complainant, which is normally the employer. The second role player is the offender, which is the employee. And then the third role player is an independent chair that now actually, basically, as we've seen on Judge Judy and all of these wonderful TV shows where this person is in the middle of the fight and regulating the whole situation and coming to a decision without fear or favor. So a lot of people confuse.
Can I just quickly interrupt? Because I'm thinking now of a situation at one of our schemes where the chairperson, in fact, the complainant or the employer, did a disciplinary hearing with the employees, where he acted as the presiding officer as well. And this matter was referred to CSOS. And in fact, the scheme or the employer won the case despite the situation. And I found that very interesting.
Yeah,
they used three parties, complainant, the defendant, and an independent person. So the complainant can't fulfill both roles. That's how I have it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Because the problem is, and as much as the guys won the case and it's great, I assume the merits were warranting or making this situation better, but ultimately then you give the individual grounds to say, listen, this wasn't an independent person. This was Umi Yohana, who's been shouting at me the whole time. Before we had the disciplinary hearing, he's already made his decision. It was actually just a formality. So to try and avoid that, it's always advisable to get this independent chair.
I'm sorry for the interruption. I was just thinking of the situation where there was definitely no three parties involved.
No, that's it's actually crazy. But I mean, that's why we're talking about this, and that's why it's important to get the word out.
Okay.
And then, second to last, the scheme must inform the employer of his or her rights. So there's a lot of rights that we need to inform them of when we take labor action. Some of these rights include that you've got the right to an interpreter, you've got the right to be represented by a union representative, you've got the right to adduce evidence, you've got the right to rebut the evidence that the employer gives. But it's important that when we give individuals notice, that these rights are actually contained in the document.
All right.
And then last but not least, and I would say this is the silver bullet at some point, mutual separation agreements may be the way. So, I mean, when we look at the factual matrix of Umi Yohana, it sounds to me that he's quite fed up with the whole situation that's going on with the gardener and the cutting of the roses. When we get a mutual separation agreement where both parties, i.e. the scheme and the employee, agrees that, okay, I'll take my bags and I'll go and you pay me, let's, for example, say 1,000 rand and I'm happy, and we both sign a mutual separation agreement, That's a very good idea, because ultimately, if an employee signs a mutual separation agreement, it closes the door on going to the CCMA or going to the labor court.
Gee whiz, these are very valuable tips. Thank you so much for that. Okay, so before we hijack this podcast to turn into a FITZANS labor law exchange, what would you say is the most important aspects of Papaya and the scheme executive, what the scheme executive should look out for?
Yeah, look, we've done an extensive podcast on Poppy and all of the technicality. So I'm going to keep it short this time. The two most important things that I would think scheme executives needs to know is, firstly, when can a scheme collect personal information? And secondly, what to look out for before transmitting personal information to others.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So on that note, when can a community scheme collect personal information and what should they look out for before sending personal information?
So in relation to when can we collect information, we need to understand that there's numerous principles of lawful processing, but the most important one in this case is the justification for the processing information. So what is our basis in law for us to now actually have this information? In a community scheme context, we're looking at four possible justifications. The first one is that there is a statutory provision that empowers us to collect this personal information. A good example of this is Prescribed Management Rule 27, which says that a scheme must have the following personal information of their trustees, tenants, and owners. So there, the reason why we've got that personal information is because the SDSMA actually obliges us to process personal information and obliges us to keep a record. So that's the first option. Either some or other piece of legislation is requiring us to process that personal information. The second one is a contractual obligation. So this is a salient example in our context would be a memorandum of incorporation in an HOA, where the memorandum of incorporation now contractually says that we need to now, in fact, collect personal information. And that contractual relationship actually now justifies why we are collecting it. The third
I actually can't see how anyone can have a problem with that. Without having that information, how do you communicate vital information such as notices for meetings of members, whether it's full title or sectional title, informing them of increases of levies or contributions? So, but there are people that question the fact that schemes collect personal information. Sorry for the interruption again.
No worries, but that's exactly the point. So I've also seen, I've been handed over files where I send a letter of demand to an owner, and then the owner writes back to me and says, well, in terms of Poppy, I did not consent to the body corporate giving its own
attorney. Oh, wow. Do you really get that?
I have got it in the past, but I mean,
oh, my word. Okay.
And I think ultimately with Poppy in 2021 coming alive and everyone jumping around and having the stress of Poppy, I think it's actually misinformed the general public and
yes,
every second situation the door gets slammed on you with Poppy. So it said, no, I don't consent Poppy, blah, blah, blah. Then the third one, which all of the people actually now seem to cling on, is consent. So if you can't justify the processing activity because you've got the statutory or contractual obligation, then you have to revert back to consent. A good example of this is biometric access. Nowhere in the Sectional Title Schemes Management Act does it say, you know what, you need to take fingerprints of your owners, trustees, and tenants. So in those circumstances where we now want to, for the purpose of access control or whatever we need the biometric access for, when we collect that type of personal information, we would have to then get consent, because we can't justify. We can't say, listen, the SCSMA obliges us. So in those circumstances, we will...
So that would depend from scheme to scheme, basically.
base, yes. And ultimately, if we utilize it, then we will have to seek consent, because otherwise we don't have a form of justification. Then another interesting example is CCTV footage. And I mean capturing a person or their vehicle or their registration number. All of these things are processing activities. So when we deal with CCTV footage, again, the options are going to be consent or the one that I haven't dealt with, which is a mutual consideration. So it's there's a just cause as to why we are actually now processing this personal information. CCTV, very, very contentious. My suggestions in these regards are that firstly, don't point the CCTV camera into Oom Johan's living room or bedroom.
Let's rather on his roses. Fixate on his roses.
Fixate. And again, even the exclusive use gardens, I've seen huge fights about that. So like ultimately to err on the side of caution, I would think that CCTV footage should be kept in the common property areas. I mean, I know EUA is a common property, but what I'm meaning with that is in the car parks. I mean, trying to now, why do we have CCTV to try and prevent crime? So boundary walls, so that no one jumps over, that's a good idea. Where the vehicles are parked, that's a good idea, so that no one breaks in. Those types of places, I understand the use of CCTV footage. But when you start pointing it into gardens and you start pointing it into windows and wherever, then I've seen issues. And I mean, we don't have certainty. There's no matter where Oom Johan has gone to court and said, well, they're pointing it into my bedroom. I'm not happy with that. And the court now said yes or no. But I mean, to err on the side of caution, that's my suggestion. And then the last one, which is also a bit of a contentious thing, is use of access control measures for visitors. I mean, I've been to numerous schemes where the visitors now have to give their identity document or driver's license. We want to check the boots. I mean, there's a lot to do 10 push-ups. I've seen a lot of crazy requirements. Ultimately, what we need to understand, the STSMA, again, does not tell us, listen, you're allowed to impose this access control measure. But what we do have as a scheme is the right of access into the scheme. So again, we have to justify based on consent. So the visitor needs to consent for us to now actually capture his driver's license or whatever. And if they refuse to consent, then we simply tell them to exercise their property rights outside of the scheme, because then we are also going to reserve our right of admission.
Dylan, I need to hurry you up. We have 10 minutes left before the session ends, and I need to know a little. Okay, so what should they look out for?
So firstly, we need to understand who is liable for processing personal information and if there's an unlawful processing. The person who holds the information is accountable. So me as a body corporate who is obliged to process this information, let's say we give it to unit number one, the owner, because he wants whatever information and he misuses it. It's important to understand that the accountability remains with the scheme. It's a salient principle in POPI. Okay. So that's where the fear arises. We don't want to provide it necessarily because there could be a breach and we as a scheme can be held accountable. So in those circumstances, it's important that we have an indemnity and declarations.
That was the thing I was looking for. Okay.
Yes. And ultimately that whomever wants the information now actually indemnifies the scheme so that the scheme has a right of recourse. Let's say they go and email everyone about their business, which is totally unrelated to the scheme. Then we've got a right of recourse, and also find out what's the reason. Why do you want this information? Ultimately, in my mind, the scheme must only share information if it furthers the administration or management. So if it's, I want to contact owners because I want to get a quorum, because I want a meeting or something, or unit 10's geyser has burst and it looks like a swimming pool and his unit, I need to phone him, those types of things would justify. But simply, you know, I've got a new business, we're selling toilet paper.
I would like to invite you to the tupper party on Saturday afternoon.
Exactly that. So if it doesn't further the management, then you shouldn't provide it.
Okay. Important. The accountability remains with the scheme.
Yes.
Okay. Then Oftentimes, legislation does not provide us with the answers we need. And the common sense approach is to be used in order to resolve issues. You mentioned that an important component is managing service providers. How does one go about this?
So again, I like to come with my stories, but I've had clients coming to me with an invoice for painting and saying, well, sue these people because they haven't painted. Then the first question I ask my client is, well, what was the agreement? No, we only have an invoice. Okay, but what does the invoice say? No, they want to paint. Okay, but does the invoice say what paint they're using? How long they're going to be? Are there any warranties? Are there any guarantees? So again, and as it related to your labor as well, get an agreement in place. I've seen a lot of schemes when the invoice comes in, it gets paid. Now, after the fact, when the relationship sours, now we're sitting with the speaker because the invoice doesn't provide us with recourse. So just get it in writing. I mean, negotiate terms. I'm not trying to suggest that if you have now MWeb or you go to one of these big players to try and change their own contracts, but try and apply pressure. Try and see where we can actually now get our protections in place and ask yourself the question, if we need to now fight based on what we have, do we have a case? And if the answer is no, then get something in writing. If the answer is yes, then it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As an attorney, you would also be a service provider, right? So how would scheme executives manage their legal representatives?
So the first thing that I've seen in the industry is don't be dazzled by their brilliance or baffled by their BS. I know this is a family-friendly podcast, so I'll keep it at that. Because ultimately, I've seen that attorneys utilize these huge Latin terms or these highly legal technical reporting or information which we actually don't understand, and we're so pressured and just to say yes, okay, something.
And pressured and impressed.
Mm. Yes, exactly that. So it's important. If you don't understand what is happening, ask, listen, I don't understand what this means. Please explain to me. Then we can get to a situation where we're understanding what's going on. I think another important component is my attorney selling dreams? I mean, Afrikaans coins it so nicely, a ja bruur or a yes man, which is an attorney which basically just listens to the problem and what you want.
It sounds better in Afrikaans, doesn't it?
Ja, it does. And ultimately, the attorney just listens to what you're saying and then says yes and gives you exactly what you want. That's an attorney most probably selling dreams. So be cautious when talking to attorneys because they know what you want when you come with your problem. I mean, you're coming and you say, this painter didn't paint, I want my money back. So if the answer is always as easy as yes, you'll get your money back, then start wondering, is my attorney not selling dreams? We need to have realistic conversations where an attorney can tell you, listen, these are your shortcomings. Maybe we can get past them, maybe not. But where there's a relationship where we can actually now have a realistic situation and basically a realistic forecasting as to how we think the matter would progress. Then coming to the swear words in the legal profession, I think there's two swear words in the legal profession. The first one is progress reporting and the second one is fees. So firstly, as a client, I would say from a progress reporting perspective, you are entitled to a progress report. You are entitled to a report that puts you in a position to understand where we are. I've seen attorneys charging amounts of money for progress reporting. I think that should start giving you question marks. Why are we paying them to tell us what is happening?
Yeah.
A progress report needs to, I mean, how do you give feedback? You can't, that attorney's clock seems to be running the whole day. And unfortunately, if that is the case, it's going to be an expensive litigation endeavor. Because now we have to pay them to tell us where we are. So that's a big no-no in my mind. And then secondly, fees. Especially as a managing agent, there's a lot of leverage that we have to say, listen, I've got X amount of complex. Even as trustees, we've got 10 units that are in arrears, for example. We must utilize this fact that we're duplicating instructions to try and leverage to get the fees down. And ultimately, in my mind, any businessman is negotiable. So if there's a circumstances, start negotiating with the attorneys. The mandate that they send at the end of the day may not be the final mandate, but if you don't ask, you won't receive. So try and negotiate so that you are also comfortable with the fees.
Okay. So now you've given us your part. So as a managing agent, I'm also a service provider of community schemes. So how does scheme executives go about managing us?
So firstly, and I think this is the interesting starting point in the situation, is that we're dealing with this managing agent's dilemma. And let me just unpack this dilemma. So the first component of this dilemma is that property practitioners are expected to provide a professional service. And we can see this from the Property Practitioners Act, which is steps towards actually now professionalizing the industry. But in the same breath, as a managing agent, we actually...
And making me gray before my time to be added.
Yes, exactly that. And then on the other hand, we now have a situation where we are actually in this master servant or agency agreement where we are an agent of the body corporate. And I mean, as an agent, you act on the instructions of your scheme executive. Mm-hmm. So now the practical problem comes in where a body corporate or scheme executives now provide you with an instruction, for example, switch off the electricity of a unit or disconnect remote access or whatever the case may be. When now the professional in the managing agent says, no, we can't do this. This is spoliation. This is unlawful. But the agent in the managing agent wants to now actually adhere to this instruction. And that's where we're now sitting with this dilemma in the industry. And I think, and this would be criticism that I would level to normal managing agents. Luckily, Fitzon is not normal managing agents, but it's important that we educate scheme executives. I think that's the foundation of a professional relationship.
Yeah, so luckily, I totally agree.
Got this amazing podcast, so I can't say it. I would have loved to say something negative, but I can't, unfortunately. And the point of the matter is that where we have an educated scheme executive, they would understand that it's unlawful to switch off electricity without a court order. And in those circumstances, we can't do this. So educating scheme executives are important. From a managing agent's perspective, diplomatic resistance, replying to the switch off of electricity. Because, I mean, this comes from a point of frustration, in my view. Unit number 10 hasn't been paying for 6 years. His indebtedness is huge. I'm fed up. Switch off his water and electricity. Maybe considering diplomatic resistance in the sense of, hi, Wimyuan, I understand that there's a situation going on and I understand your frustration, but unfortunately, just switching off someone's electricity is unlawful and we need to approach court and get a court order and then we can do it. So in those circumstances where we now actually try and dissolve the whole frustration, then there's a situation where we can now ultimately try and guide our trustees and guide our scheme executives towards making the right decision. So yeah, it's definitely a pickle that managing agents fall in, whether we should just blindly follow the instructions or whether we should actually act like the professionals we are expected to be. And I must say, I'm glad that I'm not in that predicament.
Story of our lives. Dylan, thank you so much. This was so informative and so interesting. I really wish that we could talk for another hour, but maybe that's good reason for booking you again. Thank you really for your contribution. Much appreciated.
Well, it's a huge pleasure, and I just want to say thank you. I think this is an awesome platform, and I think you guys should keep on doing this good work. I mean, there's not a lot of managing agents doing this, and I mean, this just shows the sterling work that Fitzan has done and that they're continuing to do in the industry. So, yeah, thank you very much.
So, ladies and gents, there you have it. We hope that you found this informative as well. If you want to know more, please visit our website at www.fitzan. Thank you so much. We'll talk again soon.
This was Fitzan's Property Exchange, hosted by Pearl Skeltimer. Not only do we keep you informed on the very latest in the property industry, we also empower by expanding your knowledge base. Make sure to visit www.fitzan.co.za to find out more about about sectional title scheme management, letting, sales, and trustee training. Remember to subscribe to our channel and follow us on all our social platforms.